Welcome to Still Scared Talking Children's Horror, a podcast about creepy, spooky, and disturbing children's books, films, and TV. I'm Ren Wednesday, your other co-host is Adam Wybray, and today we're talking about the 2017 kind of graphic novel Thornhill by Pam Smy. A full transcript of this episode will be available, so check the show notes for that. Enjoy! Good evening, spooky Adam.
Good evening, creepy Ren.
Ooh, it's October, so now everything's even creepier.
It is. Like, yeah, if you woke up the other day and was like, oh, why does it feel so creepy? That's because you didn't realise that the non-creepy September had shifted over into the very creepy October.
Yep. Sorry.
And all the Nancy comics at the moment are about spooky things, so that's good.
We've had a couple of witches related episodes, but now we're onto a different classic spooky entity with Thornhill, which is a recent book. By Pam Smy, and it only came out last year, 2017. And we're gonna spoiler the whole thing, so you know, read it. It's good. Read it.
Yeah, I think we've both agreed that it's really worth reading. So maybe get a copy for your library if you can't afford to buy it, because the actual book itself, it's got black edged or lined pages. What's that part of the page called? The end of the page, you know, the sheaf of the page, the leaf. I'm gonna say that. So the leaf of the page is black.
Yeah. So it's quite an impressive book to look at. Would look good in your local library amongst the comics and graphic novels, even though it isn't really that either.
No, it's not. It's a picture book, I suppose. Partly. So the only thing I've read that in form is very similar to it is Phoebe Glockner's Secret Diary of a Teenage Girl, which I also absolutely love, although it's less child appropriate. Although I think good for teenagers and older teenagers, but that contains diary extracts interspersed with sequences of comics drawing and full page comics. So here it's just full page comics. So they're all splash pages, but they do have a sequence to them. And then between those, you get these fictional diary extracts.
Yeah. And so there has these two strands of narrative, and one narrative is told through the diary extracts and one is told through the illustrations, which is a really interesting effect. But they come to intersect, but they're about two lonely girls, Mary, who's an orphan at the Thornhill Institute for Children in 1982, and Ella, who has just moved into a house that overlooks the tumble down, closed up remains of Thornhill in 2017. And it takes turns between Mary's diary entries and drawings of Ella sort of exploring the house, exploring the the overgrown grounds of Thornhill.
And I think that relationship becomes increasingly apparent, right? At first, it's quite hard, apart from the fact that we're dealing with two lonely girls, to relate the two stories. It's only quite late that Ella actually comes across Mary's diary.
Yeah.
So it's not set up right from the beginning of, she's reading this diary, now we're getting the diary extract. At first, it's quite mysterious what the relationship between the two is.
Yeah. I thought it was a really like well-fitting choice with the story of how to tell it, because one of the main aspects of Mary's character is that she rarely talks, or like she finds it really hard to talk to most people.
And she's referred to as having selective mutism.
Yeah. And Ella's story strand is entirely silent because it's just these wordless illustrations. Sometimes have notes, like a note her dad's left to her or something. But it means that they basically communicate when they start sort of interacting. They're communicating through gestures rather than words, and you never see them exchange any words. It's all gestures and puppets. So I thought that was like a nice choice of how to do it.
Yeah, and I think it, you know, it's not a game book or an adventure book, but it leads just this slight edge of interactivity to it, or investigation. You know, I think because you're having to work out the relationship between these two different strands, and the diary is positioned within the fiction of the book, I don't know, to me, it kind of, maybe it's because the book itself also is this kind of big, slightly imposing looking object. It just gave it a certain edge to me. Like it made, I guess it foregrounded the experience of reading it. You know, I was very aware of this book as an object in my room. And I think, you know, not in a way that was charming as an adult, right? not that I was massively scared of it, but, you know, I looked forward to reading more of it. I read it over a week or two. But as a kid, I talked last time about the Book of the Witches seeming like a kind of cursed book. And if I was a small kid, I can totally imagine Thornhill having that.
Yeah, I think it's partly how the drawings are done as well. I mean, because they're all 2-page spreads, like they're big, and it kind of, I don't know, it felt to me kind of luxurious how much space each image is given. Like, for example, like there's a spread like sort of near the beginning of the building Thornhill at night, seen from Ella's bedroom window. And so the next 2 pages are the exact same image, but just the sky has darkened a bit. And I think it kind of makes it feel sort of really slow and rich and ponderous. And
Yeah, lovely, dark and deep.
Yeah, and there's also entirely blank pages between sort of, there's a few pages of illustrations, then some black pages, and then we get onto the diary. So,
Of course. What do those black pages do for you?
I think they just slow you down, sort of make you think about what's just happened to the character before you move on to the next character again.
Yeah.
Like when you see something bright and you close your eyes and like the bright thing kind of sparks in front of your eyes.
Right.
If that makes sense.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
The black page kind of just gives that space for what's just happened to, like, I don't know, spark in you.
Right. It's like it's a moment of unconsciousness almost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'll give a bit of the plot. Mary's from Mary's side. So she's a resident at Thornhill as it's closing down. And at the beginning of her book, her diary tells us that she, the capital letter, is back. There's another girl who's never named, but who torments Mary mercilessly. She acts as a ringleader to the group of girls at Thornhill, and bullies Mary. Well, the care workers are fairly indifferent. So Mary's respite is to hide away in her attic room making dolls and puppets, and her favourite being the doll Mistress Mary, based on the character from The Secret Garden. So Mary sort of goes out into the grounds and she finds her own secret garden, but the bullies find her there too. And it's kind of about that point in Mary's narrative that we find out through Ella's narrative that Mary died just before Thornhill closed down, through a newspaper that Ella's looking at. It doesn't say how she died. So we sort of go into the second half of the book with that knowledge. As the institute closes and more girls are rehomed, it comes down to just Mary and the bully. And the last straw comes when the bully breaks into Mary's room and trashes it, like pulling the heads off of all her puppets and dolls. So for Mary's revenge, she pieces her dolls back together, but leaves takes one broken limb or piece from each of them and stitches them together into a kind of monstrous faceless doll. She tricks the caregivers into leaving and hangs the doll up in the pantry and forces the bully in there with it. So it's hanging in the pantry while the bully is trapped in there. And she pours paraffin under the door and determined to set Thornhill and the bully alight. But the bully tricks Mary one last time and tells her that she wants to change and be friends, and Mary lets her out. But then she sneers at Mary and runs away. And Mary decides that she's never going to leave Thornhill. So essentially Mary's narrative.
How did you find Mary's narrative voice? Like, you know, did she speak to you?
I mean, I felt for her. I felt sorry for her. It's quite... There's like a bit where the bullies sort of kind of trick her into thinking that they're including her in their games and routines, but then that's only just to be crueler when they reject her. I felt like, you know, you really feel Mary's pain at that.
Yeah. It definitely brought back quite a lot of memories of being bullied for me. I'd be loath to say that I found it triggering, but it perhaps bordered on that. I think it did a good job at getting across that feeling of inescapability you have when you're bullied as a kid. This sense that adults don't understand and you're going to have to go to school and the same thing's going to go on, and that kind of just grim, almost fated sense of inevitability that there's nothing you can do about it and it's going to happen. And how much worse, right, if you're
locked up. You have to live with them as well.
If you have to live with them as well, exactly. And I think it got across the kind of petty degradations, that kind of casual cruelty. One thing that's done to her is someone spills their drink all over her food. That was something that was done to me repeatedly at school, of people pouring my drink out over my sandwiches. And so that was just something that really rang home to me.
Yeah.
And it's the kind of thing that as a kid you can't really, you know, it seems too small to complain to the teacher about, or they'll just sort of say, oh, you were being clumsy, or, you know, there's no way to really prove it. But at the same time, you know, it's stopping you from eating.
Yeah.
So it's this sort of seemingly small thing, but actually if it's done to you regularly, you know, day after day, you're having to skip your packed lunch, you know, several days in a row or something. That's really awful.
Mm. Yeah.
And I think it did a good job at getting across the sense of injustice that engenders. And I think, sadly, that's what can breed. I mean, certainly when I look back on myself as a teenager, and, you know, I think this is true, there's been a lot of conversations about sort of toxic geek masculinity and such. And I think there's some truth to that. But I think it kind of comes from, especially if you've been bullied at school, you just can't see yourself as anything but a victim because you felt really victimised. So, you know, the idea you could have privilege seems unthinkable because, well, I don't feel like I've got privilege. And, you know, I think men have to get past this, but I definitely think that's probably where some of it comes from, at least. Is, you know, I remember, I like the fact that you feel sorry for her, and yet it doesn't skip out on that feeling of righteous anger that she has. Because I definitely remember, yeah, I guess self-pity and the way that can curdle into a kind of righteous anger and, you know, a real kind of bitterness, I think, potentially. I like the fact, I think some reviewers I saw on Goodreads had a real issue with this. They said, oh, it was just trying to say that, oh, the victim is victim blaming. It's just saying that Mary's as bad as the bully after all. But I don't think it's doing that. I think it's trying to, you know, be realistic about the psychological consequences of long-term bullying.
Yeah, no, I'd agree. I think it doesn't feel like, you know, it's the right thing to do to
burn a bully alive.
Burn a bully alive.
Which I haven't done, for the record.
But you can see how she's got to that point.
Yeah.
It feels fairly inevitable that she's going to snap at some point.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I like that she's not set up as this sort of perfect victim, because that's, you know, that's how you get to like Little Dorrit, right? I mean, that's one of the issues I have with some of Dickens's stuff. These, you know, long-suffering, often female children who are put upon and yet, you know, have the heart of gold and, you know, die with love in their eyes.
Yeah, well, I mean...
Yeah.
I mean, this kind of comes into the tie-ins with the Secret Garden as well, but sort of Mary's described as quite unlikable. Right, by a care worker.
Which she overhears.
Yeah, which she overhears. The Mary in the Secret Garden is a really horrible character at the start of the book.
Really? Is age? I think, I don't know if I ever read it. I remember the TV adaptation when I was a kid, so it's a long, long time.
Yeah, I read, at least the first two-thirds of it today.
Oh, okay.
And it'd been a long time for me as well. But, the Mistress Mary is a really quite unlikable child. She's kind of been both neglected and spoiled. And her parents have just died, and she's come to a new, like, she was in India and she's come to England into this big country manor. And she's sort of, and everyone keeps talking, like telling her like, what an ugly and crotchety child she is. but she kind of basically starts to become a better person by sort of having partly through experiencing kindness and having friends and also learning to look after herself and go out and be in nature and things. But I think it's there's definitely a parallel between the two characters that's drawn on in Thornhill.
And you see a copy of, I mean, she in the diary explicitly says that she loves the secret garden, she's reading it, and then in one of the drawings you also see the secret garden on Ella's bookshelf as well.
Oh, I didn't notice that.
Yeah, so we should talk a bit about Ella. Obviously there's less to say, because as you say, you have to infer it all through the drawings. We never see Ella say anything at all.
Yes. So Ella's, just moved into the house overlooking Thornhill with her father. On her walls, there's photos of her mother with her, and we assume that her mother has died. And Ella is curious about Thornhill immediately, and she kind of goes out and sneaks round the boarded up gate and through the barbed wire. But it's all locked up and it starts to rain, so she runs away. But a while later, she's in her bedroom and she sees the figure of a girl in the grounds. So she rushes out, but when she gets there, the girl has disappeared. Instead, she finds the head of a doll and takes it back with her. She restores the doll head and brings it back to the area, which we know from Mary's narrative is like what she calls the secret garden. She finds another doll and brings that back to her bedroom. And then Ella finds out about the history of Thornhill and connects the girl in the garden that she saw with Mary, who's dead. Although this doesn't seem to really unnerve her at all.
No.
She's just curious. Like, yeah. But it's when she goes back again and sees Mary again, she like runs after her, and Mary rushes into the house and into the attic bedroom away from her. Ella creates a puppet of Mary and lays it at the statue in the garden. And then kind of, it seems sort of like in payment, a crow gives her the key to Mary's bedroom door, which is kind of a parallel to the secret garden where a robin shows Mary the way, like, where the key is buried.
Ah, okay, that's nice to know, because I found that a little bit inexplicable.
Okay, yeah.
Reading Thornhill, so, yeah, okay.
So Ella goes into Mary's bedroom and finds all the puppets that Mary's made, and the puppets that she's ones laid next to Mary's ones. She finds Mary's diary, and then she pulls back the cover of the bed to find the monstrous puppet. Which finally is the thing that scares her, and she runs away. But so Ella starts to read
The closest thing the book has to a jump scare, really.
So Ella reads what we've already read as in Mary's diary.
It was unusual, I think, like having the character catch up to us in our reading.
Yeah, it was.
And we see her reading pages we've already read.
So she writes a note for Mary asking if they could be friends, and goes over to deliver it. We see her and Mary holding hands in the illuminated window of the dark house, but lightning strikes the building and sets it on fire. And at the end we see newspaper articles about Ella being missing, and then a body being found in Thornhill. A new boy moves into Ella's room, and as he looks across, like at the now very, very burned down Thornhill, he sees two figures holding hands in the garden, and it's Ella and Mary.
Yeah, and I mean, the picture of him moving in is very similar to the picture of Ella moving in. So it seems like there's going to be an endless, eternal return of child death, I guess.
I mean, yeah, there's definitely a bit of something sinister there, isn't it? Like, they're potentially looking for recruits.
Yeah. It's one of those endings that the more I thought about it, the more troubling I found it, because the more it seems that Mary has entrapped Ella and kind of led her to her doom so she can have another friend, and that,
I mean, that's the thing. I mean, I've been thinking, like, about the ending, like, because I think it's definitely a happy ending for Mary, because she gets the friend that she's always wanted to keep her company in Thornhill.
Well, it's certainly not a happy ending for Ella's father.
Well, yeah, I mean, we never see Ella's father. He's always at work, so we only know about him through notes he leaves to Ella on the breakfast table saying, "Sorry, love, I won't be home for dinner." And yeah. But yeah, I mean, we know, like, at the end of Mary's narrative, she says that it's her choice to never leave Thornhill. But we don't really get anything like that from Ella, you know. I feel like there could have been other options for her than dying and being Mary's forever friend.
Yeah, and like what at first seemed like the ghost Mary being shy, and now seems potentially like she was luring, you know, that she was trying to get pursued into this house.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I like it becomes kind of more sinister in retrospect.
Yeah, I mean, and there is a page where we first get a close-up of Mary's face in the garden. Like, Ella's, like, craning out of the window to look at her. And Mary's expression is... I don't really know how to describe it. It's a bit unnerving.
Yeah, like, knowing?
Knowing, yeah, exactly. So, I don't know, she might... I don't know if that marries or what she sees.
But I like that about it, right?
Yeah.
I like that this isn't just sort of the tragic waif ghost child, like, I don't know, in a Decemberist song, you know? I like that... It has that really sinister undercurrent to it. I mean, it really is a proper kind of gothic ghost story. The book has quite a lot of reviews on Goodreads, and not all of them are positive. Quite a few people have issue with the ending. And some people seem to have wanted Mary to take revenge on the bully, and they said, antagonist wins at the end, is how one person put it. And I mean, if Mary had won, she wouldn't be a ghost. she wouldn't be hanging around with unresolved issues. Like, you don't get ghosts when they're like, yeah, my business here is finished. Just gonna hang around as a ghost. Like,
I mean, she wouldn't even have died.
Yeah.
Necessarily.
So you wouldn't have a story.
So we've kind of passed that. That's kind of baked in, really.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I've got that. I mean, that wasn't a problem for me. I mean, it's certainly a downbeat ending. But, I mean, the whole book is quite a dour tone.
Yeah.
Like, it's a gloomy book. You know, there's lots of Ella crying.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, it's a really sad illustration of when she comes down for breakfast and her dad's already left for work and just, like, left the kitchen a mess, and she's, like, just crying, doing the washing up, and it's just like, oh, God.
Yeah, that's a bit heartbreaking.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I can't really imagine... This book, I mean, you know, you could say it's an ambivalent ending. As you say, Mary has a friend and Ella has a friend, whether she chose to have this friend or not. But, yeah, to me it felt very... I mean, some other people said it was predictable, which maybe is more fair, but I just can't see how it could have been any other way.
Mm.
You know, that's the thing with ghost stories, really. They can only end one way. You know, that
yeah.
inevitability, as you say, is baked in. But that ties in. It ties in to that sense you have as a child of your life not being your own and that adults control your life, especially if you're at an orphanage or a care home. Right. Mm. And that ties into that feeling of powerlessness Mary has about being bullied. Right.
Yeah.
She can't imagine her life going any other way.
Mm.
So, yeah, that's bleak, but it felt emotionally honest to me, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, we kind of sort of see we read about Mary's loneliness explicitly, but sort of Ella's is kind of conveyed through drawings of like a sort of empty, messy house and uncared for gardens just piled high with junk and kind of the photos of her mother on her wall. So I don't know, it seems like Ella's feeling a similar sort of overwhelming bleakness just by how her and her surroundings are drawn.
Oh yeah, and there's a lot of deliberate drawing parallels between the two girls, obviously.
Yeah.
So Ella gets into making puppets much as Mary made puppets.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, and they don't look wholly dissimilar either.
Yeah. And also, I don't know if you thought this, but there's a point where Mary describes making a puppet that looks like the opposite of her, and it's quite like how Ella is drawn.
Yeah. Oh, I had a vague sense of that. There's another bit where Mary writes about sitting in the garden.
Mm.
And it's as though she were a puppet.
Yeah.
And that there's someone watching over her, which is really strange.
Yeah.
Because is this like a presentiment of Ella?
Yeah, Ella makes her as a puppet.
Yeah, in the future. I don't know, yeah. Like, you know, when you, that thing about, I love that phrase of, I felt a chill where someone just walked over my grave.
Yeah.
Because what does that mean? Like, does that mean that, so in the future, someone at this moment walked over my grave? In the future moment?
Yeah.
Like. Do you get what I mean? Like, does that,
yeah,
is that
yeah.
what the expression means? Because obviously I don't have a grave at the moment. You know, I haven't got like a grave in my garden ready for me to get into. At the moment,
yeah,
there is no grave.
It's a pretty, surreal for like an everyday expression.
Yeah. So it's got to be the future grave.
Yeah.
So it's like a presentiment of...
A presentiment of being in your grave.
Yeah. And someone not respecting my being in my grave. carelessly walking over it. But it's always walking though, isn't it? Like, you never say, oh, I just felt someone having a wee on my grave.
Mm, playing cricket on my grave.
Yeah.
No.
Having sex on my grave.
Oh my God, what would that feel like?
Yeah. Yeah, strange metaphysics, I think.
Mm, yeah. But the puppet thing of imagining herself as a puppet, I thought tied into the drawing style a bit.
Okay.
Because there's the way the figures are drawn, they're quite simple and expressive and like a bit gangly. Like, I feel like their limbs like sit a bit off, kind of in a slightly puppet-like way.
Yeah, it's drawn in quite a loose sort of style. Like, say, it reminded me a bit of your illustrative style.
Mm.
In that everything looks quite fibrous and organic.
Yeah.
Yeah, everything looks like it should be in a state of kind of flow. Like everything looks a little bit permeable and a little bit sort of, not wibbly exactly, but yeah, kind of loose.
Yeah. It tends towards like simple characters and like very crammed, intricate backgrounds with lots of textures, like ivy growing all over the place, or like all the scuffed and cobwebs inside Thornhill, which I quite like. I mean, that's definitely my thing.
And the drawings of the puppets.
Oh yeah, yeah. Yeah, which are great. I wanted to draw out one more parallel with the between the two girls and sort of the connection with the secret garden.
Okay.
It's the idea of magic and sanctuary. And in the secret garden, obviously, it's this garden that the Mistress Mary finds that's been locked for 10 years, and the Robin shows her where the key is, and she gets in there, and it's the first time she's had a place of her own where she can grow things, and it's so that's like, you know, her sanctuary. Her Mary, her room is a similar thing. It's it talks about it as like the only place where she feels safe. It's sort of right at the top of the house. It has all her puppets. And Ella's room sort of feels the same way. It's kind of, it's the only place that's drawn to look comfortable. It has sort of books and cards and photos and decorations compared to the kitchen, which is sort of piles of unwashed laundry and the surrounding area that seems a bit run down. But yeah, there's definitely something about finding a space that is magical, and then like how much of a betrayal it is for Mary for the bully to come and destroy that.
I kind of wanted to read the description of the monstrous hybrid puppet that she creates in anger, because is a one of the most sort of evocative pieces of writing in the book, I think. So, 11th of August, 1982. I've been awake all night, and it is nearly done. I am dizzy with excitement, hot with anger, sick with hate for her, sick of her. I'm sick of it all. I have made her. I've taken the remains of my puppets and I've stitched and glued them together to make her. Not as they see her, not the confident, rosy-cheeked beauty with golden ringlets and blue eyes, but as I know her to be. Cold, heartless, ugly in thought and mind. She is snot and bile. She is pus and spit and piss. She is a horror, and I want her to see what she is. I have snipped, snipped, snipped pieces of arms and legs from the bodies of my puppets and stitched them together to form my life-sized monster's face. Her eye sockets made from crushed papier-mâché arms and tiny hands. The cheeks stitched from tatters of fabric she had ripped from my puppets' bodies. I've stuck glassy, beady eyes as warts on her face and collaged them together as a necklace for my monster. I have stitched tufts of hair into her body and glued shards of clay and plastic into scales for her skin. I have stuffed her with foam and torn costumes and papier-mâché. And I have cried. I have cried as I have used parts of my old damaged friends. Cried as I recognised bits of characters I planned and crafted and loved. I have invested my time and my care in each of them. They were beautiful. Now these broken pieces are ugly and are building something uglier, and I can't stop the tears falling onto my hands as I cut and stitch and glue and scrape. But now I have made her, and now I can destroy her. Ah, fearsome piece of writing, that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good. It's really good. And the illustration is as horrific or more even than you might imagine from that description.
Yeah.
It really sells the horror of that puppet.
Right. Mm. Should we do texture of the week?
Hmm. Yeah, all right.
Texture to texture, texture to texture. I gave that fan a good scrabbling.
Oh,
it's good. What it deserves.
You show it. Yes, absolutely.
Well, I've read mine, so you know, I'm done.
Oh, right, was that yours?
Read it.
Yeah, I mean, that was mine as well. It's clearly the best texture.
It's clearly the best texture, isn't it? Yeah. Don and Dustin. Yeah.
I mean, our first texture of the week, we were in agreement that the...
Was that Beetlejuice?
That Beetlejuice grave...
AstroTurf grave.
At grave AstroTurf was obviously the best texture. Sometimes they're just this
Yeah,
one.
Sometimes there's objectively a texture of the week, and this week there is.
Yeah. Yeah. Any further thoughts, or are we...
No, I think we're pretty done and dusted. Just to say that, yeah, I really liked it. I found it quite moving. It was creepy. It's a great late night reading. I really like the illustrations. I think you said to me in text that the only drawback, if any, is some of the dialogue's a little clunky.
Oh, yes, I did... I think there was when there's conversations of the care workers talking to each other, they use each other's name every time they say something, which I found a bit distracting because that's not really how people talk.
Yeah.
but that is that's a minor.
Yeah,
trouble.
I mean, overall, I really like it, and I'm definitely going to make sure to look out for what Pam Smy does next.
Mm, yeah, definitely.
So yeah, I think recommendations for all kind of creepy kids and spooky adults.
So our so we now have our new and updated theme tune, which is very exciting. Homeki Yamazaki, as always. Our outro is by Joe Kelly. Our artwork is by Letty Wilson. I'll put all their details in the show notes, and you can get in touch with us at stillscaredpodcast@gmail.com or at stillscaredpod on Twitter. Also, apparently I was bad and wrong to tell people that they could just click the stars on iTunes rather than also leaving
a review.
Well,
you're never bad
apparently
and wrong.
But apparently that doesn't count for very much, Adam. They have to leave a review as well.
Yeah. Well, I hope they do. But we've had some really nice emails, actually, the last month. So thank you for those. And, it's really nice to get some suggestions in as well. I'm sure we'll be covering some of those in the coming months.
Absolutely. Do you have a sign-off?
Yeah, just to say... Don't look into the windows opposite your house too late at night, creepy kids.
Yeah, you don't know what the ghost is planning. See you next time. Bye.
Toodles.